Welcome to the Motoring Podcast, your weekly discussion of motoring news. This is episode 74 on Tuesday, the 29th of November, 2016. Hello, I'm Alan.
Hello, I'm Andrew.
Was a bit of a pause. I'm sorry.
Good job we haven't been doing this a while.
Yeah, totally.
Come on, let's get straight into follow-up. And I'm going to leave this one to you because you had to apologise for getting this company wrong previously. So
yeah, so it's been through a couple of times. we talked before about Otto, the formerly Israeli Uber purchased autonomous driving company who specialise in autonomous driving of commercial vehicles rather than doing it with our everyday cars, like many autonomous driving systems are looking at. And there has been a little bit, I'm not going to say it got as far as uproar, let's say consternation, shall we, in that whenever Otto were running the self-driving Volvo truck experiment, taking all that Budweiser across Nevada, they may or may not have broken Nevada's autonomous vehicle testing laws. It's not illegal to have autonomous vehicle testing, driverless vehicle runs, not illegal in Nevada, but it's possible that Otto missed out on the appropriate testing beforehand and or permit requirements that are actually necessary. So Nevada's Department of Motor Vehicles mandates that companies submit a permit application, a $5 million bond, and proof that their self-driving vehicles have done 10,000 miles of testing before they can be allowed on roads in the state. People don't seem to be 100% certain whether or not that was received in the appropriate manner.
But that's not the only problem with this, because if Otto hadn't provided the relevant information and guarantees, there is nothing in Nevada's statute to do with this in which they could prosecute Otto for not doing that.
Yeah.
So they brought a law in that's not actually enforceable.
Yeah, it's like, well, you didn't do it. It's about as far as any telling off can go.
It's a tricky one for these states, though, because each of the states is trying to make out that they are the welcoming home to autonomous vehicle testing, because they can see how much it would mean to the states if they could be bases for industry and production and manufacturing. So it's a bit of a tightrope for them to walk. They just haven't thought it through that, oh, actually, we need to have, you know, the penalties as well included in this.
Yeah, so this Automotive News article, which is our main source for this, says that there's the administrator for the Management Services and Programs Division of the Nevada DMV, a chap called Jude Huron. He's saying that there is a new set of autonomous vehicles regulations scheduled for submission in 2017. It's intended to include penalties for violations. But he also said, what we have here is a misinterpretation of the law. We still have a great working relationship with Otto. The technology is living, breathing, and changing as we speak. So, yeah, they're needing to hurry up with this. But on the other hand, it may well just be a misinterpretation rather than anything actively illegal, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Rather than an intent to break the law.
Yes.
So anyway, that's all we've got really for follow-up this week, isn't it?
It is. It's nicely short.
So, Andrew, speaking of these kind of things, you came across a story about JLR.
Yes. I checked the date, and it was not towards the beginning of April, but Jaguar Land Rover had a big vocal time about how they're going to make 10,000 UK jobs to build the electrical vehicles. This is all on the back of the I-PACE.
If I may, they said, according to this Autocar article by Sam Sheehan, it says Jaguar Land Rover could create up to 10,000 new jobs. in the UK.
Fully expected to, was other quotes I heard.
Oh, right.
As well. But what they were... This, to me, smacked of, well, we've seen what Nissan just did publicly. Mm-hmm. So we are going to publicly say very positive things that could happen, which will force the government to take us seriously, because they need positive stories at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Bully them, possibly, into forking out some money to help put the infrastructure that would be needed, that Jaguar Land Rover have openly declared is needed for them to be able to build these plants, or the plant in the West Midlands in which to produce the cars or the batteries.
Mm-hmm.
It makes nice headlines.
It does, especially as it came only a couple of days after the autumn statement from the Treasury, which one of the things that they announced in that, they being the government, pardon me, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, they'd announced that they wanted to make the UK a global leader for electric vehicle and battery propulsion. It's kind of convenient, given that Nissan have a very large battery plant in Sunderland.
Oh, do they?
They do. They do. Wow, coincidentally, they do. Yes. Isn't that jolly awesome? That was in there along with some of the rest of the autumn statement as well. What else did they talk about? Should we talk about the good stuff first, and then we can have a gurn about the not-so-good stuff later on? So, fuel duty. It has been frozen at 57.95 pence per litre of fuel sold.
Yes.
Well, it's not gone up.
I'm beginning to grow weary of how this is focused on, because I don't believe any government will stick this up unless it is trying to commit political suicide. Or with that desperate for cash, because it's a very easy one for them to turn around and say, we do love the motorist. Look how much we love the motorist. Because if they were really serious about this, there's been plenty of studies done that show if they cut it by 3p, how much of a benefit that would be to the economy, and how much that would stimulate growth and jobs and push more money through the whole, you know, GB UK PLC.
Yes. I'll slap you for that later on.
What for?
The GB PLC bit. I just hate it when people say that. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's true. And one of the things is that the with the fuel duty stuff is that people can, it's a curious one, because it's a tax people can choose whether to pay or not to pay, whether or not they do actually want to use their cars.
Mm.
And as we either use our cars less, or we have more economical cars, then, of course, the amount of money that comes in from this goes down.
Well, I mean, when the crash hit 2007, 2008, people did stop using their cars significantly.
Yeah.
And the government lost a massive chunk of income.
Hugely.
So they can see how it actually does happen. They've got the they've got the figures, they've got the statistics, they have the pretty pie charts and graphs that will show them. You know what? If people stop driving, we don't get income. Let's not penalise them then.
Let's not penalise them there. But so what we'll do is we will increase the tax on things that we have mandated that they have, no matter how much they drive their car. And that, of course, is a further 2% rise in insurance premium tax. So we can all watch. We can all watch that go up. As is commented here, the
insurance companies will only ever put 2% on, won't they, of course?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what they do. That's how they... What they tried to tell me, the rise is due to insurance premium tax.
Yeah, I mean,
insurance premium tax is 1/20th of the amount you're trying to raise my premium here.
Yeah, it's obvious that they're always out for us, the consumer.
Oh, absolutely. The other thing about insurance premium tax is it has had 3 rises in 2 years. So it's gone from 5% to 12% in 2 years. as author of this particular Autocar article, but it makes insurance premium tax a stealth tax of our time. So it really is a stealthy one in there, which we cannot get around, but which will be, at the very worst, a standard standard level of income for the government.
Yep.
What else for us, the motorists? What can we get? Because I've now gone off and gone into all the doom and gloom.
Sorry, that was slightly my fault for. Because
it normally is if it involves doom and gloom. Yeah,
it's my job. the angry member of the Motoring Podcast.
That is about right, actually.
But Hammond did announce, not that Hammond, the Chancellor Hammond, did announce money for low emission vehicles, electrified vehicles, that sort of thing as well.
390 million-ish.
Yes.
Yeah. Will be invested in low emission vehicles, freeing up money for EV chargers and of course, there's building our competitive advantage in low emission vehicles and development of connected autonomous vehicles.
But also helping, giving perks or incentives to businesses
support
to install charging points and things like that as well.
Which can only be a good thing.
Well, that's what will really drive it, is if fleets move more that way.
Yeah.
It sort of works. It's one of those contradictions that happens with the government, but the new VED levels and rules and costs sort of contradict the we're being friendly to EVs. I think benefit in kind or something like that isn't going to be what people feared.
No, I don't believe it is, actually.
But that was quite technical, and we're going to have links to two different articles about this. We're going to have Autocars and Parkers
as well,
just so that you can read through them yourselves, and just in case you are affected by more business car related stuff. So
yeah, one last bit on this before we move on. There's another £1.1 billion to be allocated to local transport networks in England, £22 million worth, £220 million worth to address local traffic pinch points. So this sounds great. Here's hoping that the local councils spend that wisely.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
I think is all I'm going to say there.
Yes.
We know what they're like. You've seen the pictures of that stealth pseudo roundabout in Cambridge, yeah, in the middle of the road.
The one that looks like someone's just gone mad with crazy paving.
That's the one. It's the intention is to slow motorists down by confusing them.
That won't work. Then what is going to happen is people just go careering over them.
Well, it is Cambridge. So there we go. Shall we move on to the next story we're meant to be talking about, not the ones that I guess sidetrack us onto?
We could give it a go. I mean, it's an option.
Go on,
and we could, you know, really throw the listener by by sticking to an agenda. But this one is that Audi have appointed a new R&D, head of R&D. And he has come from Volvo, and it is Peter Mertens is replacing Stefan Knirsch, I think.
Yes, I would just make a run at it and say that. Yeah.
That's as best as I can do, people. I didn't check this article thoroughly enough, otherwise I would have given it to Alan. You know that.
This is what normally happens.
But Mertens has been at Volvo since 2011. And he was behind their four-cylinder strategy they've got. And he moved there from Jaguar Land Rover, where he was in charge of quality. One of the obvious reasons why he was appointed is because he cannot be tainted by Dieselgate.
Yeah, totally.
And I think it's a wise move. Mm-hmm. To bring in fresh blood, because that has been criticism that has been levelled at the Volkswagen Group, is that it's all very incestuous in its internal appointments or what looks like internal appointments, even though they're very separate companies.
Yeah.
With very different ways of doing things, and they all have to fight their own corner when it comes to the main board. But I think it can only help Volkswagen by getting fresh people in with fresh ideas, because I think they need them.
I'm inclined to agree with you. Yes, absolutely.
I am always one for bringing in the right person for the job, and making a big effort to look externally for that. Having worked in plenty of companies where internal was the main way, and you just you can't help but regurgitate old ideas.
Yes, I agree completely. That said, Mertens was at Volvo, has been at Volvo since 2011, so he's not just hopping left, right, and centre. That has been about 5 years. He's also previously worked for Mercedes-Benz and General Motors.
Oh, okay.
So he's
he knows the motoring industry.
He knows the motoring industry quite well, so I think that's really, really interesting. Yeah, and wish him well. That brings us to, I don't know if it's the middle of the show, it seems to be very close to the beginning of the show, to be honest. But that brings us to that little point in the show when I politely ask you to take a few moments to tell a friend about Motoring Podcast and Rearview, and to leave a star rating and review for us via the podcast playing platform of your choice. Most popular and powerful podcasting platform of all is iTunes, so a 5-star rating on there is hugely influential. Now, I know that every single time we talk about this, we mention iTunes. I know that sometimes when we tweet, we make a point of pointing out that it has been released on iTunes. You don't actually need iTunes to listen to the Motoring Podcast. Now, you're obviously listening, so you've worked out the right way to do it. You can listen straight from our website, and you can stream from there. You can't download from there. With an app such as Stitcher, Downcast, Overcast, and similar, I'm forgetting the name of the other one I normally recommend to people as well, then you can actually download new shows when they're available, and you can listen to them offline. And that's the big, big advantage of using a podcast app. They also give the catalogues of the podcasts that they list, and of course the ratings that you leave on those apps makes a difference to where we sit in that catalog. And of course, the higher up the listing we are, the better the visibility we get. So yes, a rating still means a lot. If you've rated, if you've left stuff for us, if you just like streaming on the website, that's fantastic. Please don't forget to tell a friend, mention the show, and show people how to subscribe or listen by whichever means works for them. Only yesterday I was speaking to someone and mentioned the podcast. He said, "Oh yeah, you've got a podcast. I really must subscribe." And I said, "Oh, why don't I do it for you just here? Because I know exactly how to do it." And I talked him through subscribing not just to Motoring Podcast, but also to Rearview from his phone in a second or two.
Oh, thank you.
So yeah, that's all right. So you, funnily enough, I've been spreading the word, but you'd expect me to, really. I've got a slightly vested interest. So yes, please. Podcast apps, doesn't have to be iTunes, can be many others. If you could leave a rating, a note of approval, that would be just fantastic. I've warbled on quite a bit there, so shall we move on?
Okay, we can. Sticking with technology and phones, though. Article that I think you spotted through.
I did, and I spotted it via Bertel Schmidt.
Yes, he tweeted.
Who actually is the author? Yeah. Oh no, he's not the author. Pardon me.
No,
not in this case.
He tweeted about it, and it's that it's been discovered that on Android, not that I am an Android user, but I know many people are, on Android, to operate via Tesla's app, They keep the owner authentication token, which is basically how you log in plain text, which, if you're not technical, means someone who can gain access to your phone can easily copy this, get in to your via your phone, and open the doors, switch on the engine, do anything you could do via your app, but it's just not secure. And Android has quite a reputation for being hackable, for malicious apps enabling people to gain access to various parts of your phone without you giving permission or knowledge. So this is actually quite a worry, and this is one of the worries about connected cars that I have. And I don't want to get too tinfoil hatty here. I'm trying to stick to.
You're walking along the tightrope, all right, just at the minute, mate.
Thank you. Do tell me when I.
Oh, don't worry, I will.
Down that cliff.
I'm ready for it. Yeah.
One of the comments in the article that you'll find in the show notes, which is from PC Perspective, is that someone made a statement that it's not fair that these issues. Tesla can be blamed for these issues because of the device's operating system. Now, I disagree with that massively, because if the operating system has known flaws and is known to be a target and an easy target and conquest for malicious code and malicious people, then you shouldn't have your app on it.
My thought is that other apps manage this, so why can't they?
Well, I mean, they've made it worse by having it in plain text.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the fundamental flaw. But if people can gain access, it'd be the same as if it was Apple. If mm-hmm. Apple had a big weakness, then I think someone who is as well known and is followed by a lot of mainstream, or you know, most of the mainstream media, if they turned around and said, "We will not allow our app on Android or Apple because there is this security issue," you would see that security issue fixed pretty quickly, which would be the benefit of everybody. So I don't stand with that statement, but it just goes to show that whilst a manufacturer can be very safe and they can have and Tesla do a great job at trying to keep their apps and their technology tight, although this is quite a glaring sort of almost a basic error. But they do work hard at it. They've got a very good bug bounty. They do mm-hmm. encourage people to, you know, they pay a lot of money if you spot a bug, which other manufacturers don't, and they pretend they do, or they hint that they do and they don't, and that needs to stop. But that's a different matter. So even someone as careful as Tesla and as switched on as Tesla to the connectivity security issues, there are so many parts to this jigsaw, and this is what really worries me about connectivity, is everything needs to work well, otherwise we as the consumer, the user, the owner are exposed. And it may not be via, you know, the car manufacturer's app. It could be because we're on a particular operating system, or it could be because we use a particular app that is on that system that has a weakness. So when we look at the whole connective ecosystem, and I will hurt myself later for saying ecosystem and using air quotes.
You're allowed that one.
Thank you. When we look at all this, it is very, very complex, and it is very hard, and it's something that we as the consumer have to turn around to the manufacturers and start saying, no, it's not acceptable. We need you to really work hard at making sure that we are safe at all times, not just in the car and the car not being hacked, but if we're having an app from you, that has to be secure. Is there weaknesses, or are there other apps that we cannot use because it will cause a weak, you know, they are weak, and therefore that has an issue for you. These are things that they need to understand, adopt, and be much more proactive at telling us.
I was listening to a podcast recently, and someone was saying that security is like water. It always finds the easiest, you know, basically hacks always find the easiest way to flow, and it can be a tiny little crack, but that's all it needs for there to be some sort of gap in your security and for people to be able to leak into it. So anyway. Does that round off Tinfoil Hat Corner there, by the way?
For the moment, yes. I think
for the moment, yes. So it's an important point. We want to make sure that these things are as secure as possible for all of us, especially as we connect more and more and more of our lives together. Speaking of connecting more and more and more, this is for us, this is incredibly hot off the press. This was only announced this morning, BMW, Daimler, Ford, and the Volkswagen Group are all cooperating BMW, Daimler, Ford, and Volkswagen are all cooperating. That's all I need to say for this to be big news. But basically, they are cooperating to plan and implement a network of around 1,000 chargers along major routes across Europe. Many of these being super quick chargers, up to 350 kilowatts.
Ding.
Drat. This is all going to be based on the combined charging system, that's CCS, which is an existing charging system, but it's... which is already used by BMW's iCars. It's already been used by VW in the e-Up and the e-Golf. And Ford and Mercedes are planning on using it as well. So this is really starting to drive some of the standardization towards CCS. There's the other sort of major one, the major... competing system really is Tesla's it's the CHAdeMO system. I'm not quite sure what that stands for, but it's got weird capital letters in the middle, and it's used by Peugeot, Citroen, Nissan, Mitsubishi. Is it used by Hyundai as well? I think so. In there, as well as Tesla's own supercharger charging system, which is proprietary, which is good. So two things: A, hopefully loads more chargers across main routes of Europe, which can be ultra fast chargers, and secondly, it's trying to really move us towards a dominant system, which hopefully others will adopt over time as well.
Yes, please, can we just pick one plug?
Yeah, please, it'll make life so much easier for so many people. So major announcement today for EV people. We really need this kind of stuff.
Yeah, because they're not only doing it fast, but they're making very big noise about putting these in the right place as well. So they're working out how far apart to put them. And the thought is going into this, it's not like a petrol station which they just sprout up everywhere. They are deliberately spacing them out, which is good, because you know that's they've got the ability now to work this out properly. Mm-hmm. And okay, it's going to be on the major routes, so we're talking motorways, that sort of stuff. However, from there it will trickle out. And just the faster, the better.
This is the traditional way of setting up infrastructures, though. If you think of it a bit like prêt-à-manger, okay, which is always my example in my head whenever I think of these things.
Okay.
And they set up in towns, and they put in maybe two or three, or one or two, in key locations, and then start to fill in around those and kind of split the distance between them.
Right.
And it's that kind of constant halving of the distance until you get to the situation that you have in many streets in central London, where you stand on the corner and each way you turn, you can see a prêt-à-manger. and that started out from some two or three key ones, and then you've got that what's called infill, of filling in the gaps in between them. So working out what that initial distance is, and then being able to kind of split the distance in between, is how we will hopefully start to see networks proliferate.
Okay,
there we go. Electric vehicles, prêt-à-manger strategy. Strategy, yes. It'll be expensive and contain rocket. prêt-à-manger strategy. What more could you ask for in a motoring podcast article? Yeah. Next one's yours. Get on with it. Stop giggling.
Okay. In America, the National Highways Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, who we've mentioned a few times on this show, have released what they are proposing as voluntary guidelines for makers and device manufacturers, including smartphone makers. This is from TechCrunch. To cut down on driver distraction from mobile apps and hardware. Now, they've been very clear that this is voluntary, but essentially what they want is airplane mode for the car. And therefore, it's being labelled driver mode, and you'll only be able to access one or two things, basically. Google has already complied with this in their Android Auto. There's larger icons to touch. It's more easy to control the navigation, music playback, that sort of thing. But they want things locked out, so you know you're not able to text while driving.
They just want non-voice text entry in general, so you can't use a keyboard when you're driving. And you're also not allowed to display large blocks of text, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. The thing for me on this is, I don't disagree with what they're saying. I've voiced it many times before on the show that, you know, using your phone, even if it's hands-free, there's lots of actual research has been done that proves how distracted you are and how impaired your reactions and your attention is. So anything that reduces that from happening is a good thing, but we still allow touchscreens in cars. And I still have a problem with that because you have to look away from the road to be able to operate most of those.
So the trouble with this in general that I can see is that basically not everyone's a driver in a vehicle. You've got passengers who want to prat about with stuff on their phone, and it's perfectly okay for passengers to be pratting around with stuff on their phone. So surely what will happen is it'll come up and say, this is only allowed if you're a passenger. Are you a passenger? It'll be like Waze. Are you a passenger? And everyone's just going to go, yeah, I'm a passenger.
Yeah.
I'm a passenger, it's fine. And then
that absolves the software manufacturer because they've...
But it doesn't solve the problem.
They've made the effort to make it clear that it's dangerous to do this, yet the stupid human behind the wheel who's going, but I need to see this email while I'm driving, or whatever it is they're trying to activate, makes that decision and will still try and claim it's not their problem, their fault.
Yeah. It's like the big annoying buttony thing that I have to press every time I start my car and turn to navigation mode to say, yes, I'm not going to play with this. And I'm not going to let this distract me when I'm driving, which I have to do every time I start the car. It's no different from that, really.
Yeah, it's like T's and C's, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit.
I like the idea that the attempted execution is not going to work. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's what I'm a bit nervous about. I don't see how it can be made to work.
The only way could be is if you connect your phone to the car it will switch itself. The car will switch it off.
Yeah, the phone will recognize.
That would be the only way that it could happen. So if you didn't connect your car, though, your phone into the car's system, into Apple CarPlay or Android Auto, then and you had your phone on a mount in the windscreen and you just used that, if you did that way, then I don't know how you can get around it without the whole, as you said, the ways, because I've seen it happen with Pokemon Go. It'll come up and say, you're in a car, you shouldn't be using this. You know, people just go, well, I'm not driving, so.
Does it actually do that?
It does say that, because it will tell, it spots how fast you're going.
Ah, okay. I've only played Pokemon Go a couple of times. Even I haven't played with Pokemon Go that much.
No, there's people I know.
I think that's a grown-up sense, but really, I do other. Okay. should we move on to List of the Week?
List of the Week.
Yes, List of the Week this week comes from Car Dealer Magazine, and it is from the Used Car Awards, which took place earlier in the week, yesterday, I think. And what we want to talk about are the list of the best used cars of the year. So, starting at the smallest, let's start the used small car of the year, which is sponsored, I'm not going to read out the sponsor's name, is won by the Fiat 500. The used mid-sized car of the year is the Volkswagen Golf. The used executive car of the year was the Audi A6. The used sports car of the year was the Porsche 911. I promise that these are not sponsored by Volkswagen Group in any way, shape or form, okay? I just want to make that clear. It doesn't show Volkswagen Group on here at all. Used SUV of the year is the Land Rover Discovery. And the overall used car of the year is, quite frankly, the... I don't know, I just couldn't be any more middle of the road, is the Volkswagen Golf.
And it goes to prove to anybody out, any ambulance-chasing lawyer out there, that Dieselgate makes no difference to residuals.
It seems not to be the case. As well as that...
If they wanted proof, there you go. That's what's promoted, because they are the cars that probably sell the best.
Mm-hmm. Well, they must do. They're fantastically safe choices. I'm sitting here sort of ridiculing and being exasperated, but that's only because...
Well, because
I am
they're so safe,
a
aren't
car
they?
Bloke, and it's only because they're so safe. It's not even that they're dull. They're not dull. I mean, it's a Porsche 911. I'd love to own a Porsche 911, but it is very much the safe, powerful sports car to choose in those. So, fantastic. Once again, it shows, you know, really when it comes to used cars, that or when it comes to selling a car, then if you choose something that is trustworthy, has a decent badge, has a decent brand behind it, a decent image behind it, then
even if that image has been severely hammered,
even if that image has theoretically, even if you're being told that image is being severely hampered, it
people don't mind. People don't mind.
No,
it doesn't. You know, it's not as though that what was Dieselgate was saying was, you know, they were spontaneously exploding or anything. It's not, that wasn't the issue, so therefore people just carried on.
It's not Vauxhall.
You said that. So, I could not possibly comment.
And anyway, we managed to get Dieselgate into it finally, because it wouldn't be an episode of...
No, we did earlier as well.
Dieselgate. Oh, we did a bit earlier.
Yeah, so...
Should we move away from the news and talk about something that we did last week?
You mean we had fun?
We did.
We did actually have fun.
We went on the jolly and had a great day out.
We had good fun.
We did. It was nice. So you noticed last week that that we recorded from the joys and delights of my sitting room rather than over the magic of Skype, as we are doing at the moment. And so Andrew's down at mine because we'd been invited to a Subaru driving day, which was happening just up the road from mine, just outside Peterborough. And Yeah, it was an interesting day. It was a nice laid back day actually, because it was quite relaxed and chilled out, and you could do what you wanted.
Let's be honest, right? Let's set this day up a bit.
Okay.
Driving days had happened. They started at the weekend and moved. We were the final day, I think.
Yeah.
So it was 3 days worth. The day I drove down was the wettest of the year. What was it, Storm Angus or whatever it was?
Yes, Hurricane. Was it not? No, it didn't get as far as Hurricane Angus.
Storm
Angus. Storm Angus. No, it was definitely Angus.
Came through the southeast and east of England and made flooded the place that we arrived in the day after, which had subsided by the time we got there.
Yes.
So this was wet. It was slippery, and that was just the roads.
Yeah. Covered in clay.
Yes.
Yeah, it was good. Yes, it was good.
So if ever there was an environment and a time to test out a Subaru and its abilities, I don't think we could have done better. I don't think Subaru could have tried harder.
No.
To make it happen in that way. So I think they were... They probably weren't thinking it was lucky at the time.
Every time it got mentioned to some people, they kind of rolled their eyes a bit. So there were a range of non-sporting Subarus were available for us to try. Okay, so there was no WRX STI, there was no BRZ. Those were the only ones that weren't really, weren't they?
Yeah.
So those weren't included, because the idea was to have off-road course available to us with patient and helpful and just generally chilled out off-road instructors to stop us just basically making a complete mess of it and breaking the cars. And there was a road route as well that was there, and there was a whole range of cars, so about 8 cars for each, weren't there?
Yeah, there was the Outback, Forester, XV, and the Vorg.
That's true. Yes, there were. Before all that, we got a little bit of a talk about Subarus and the joys and the engineering around Subarus. And there was a couple of interesting points that I noticed from in there, Andrew. The first one is that, what is it they make? I've now forgotten the number. That's terrible. Was it they make 900,000 four-wheel drive vehicles a year? Or basically double what Jaguar Land Rover make every year?
Yeah.
And one of the things that they were kept going about, and we all know this about Subarus really, so I don't know why I'm bothering to point it out, is that their four-wheel drive system is four-wheel drive, it's not all-wheel drive. So it's the word they keep using is symmetrical. So it's driving all the wheels all the time. It's not just driving the front wheels until it goes, oh, you know, actually, maybe I'm losing traction. Maybe I should move some traction to the back. Mm. It is all the wheels all the time, basically.
Yeah.
Was the first thing. The other thing that I noticed was that they were saying they're basically going for the Volvo model, trying to stop anyone dying or being killed by a Subaru.
They're just not being as vocal about that, are they?
They're just not being as vocal about it right at the minute. They have a reputation pretty much on safety. And that's me saying that, not them saying that. But no, that they were underlining as a particular aim and target for them, that they're aiming for them. Yep. The other one that got me was that over 98% of all Subarus over 10 years old are still on the road in the UK.
It was something ridiculous like
that. It was 90-odd percent. It was ridiculous.
From a business point of view for them, on one hand, is brilliant because it underlines how wonderful these, you know, how well put together these vehicles are. But on the other hand, it means people don't come back to the showroom.
Yeah, people kind of forget.
Often enough, anyway.
No. Which was a couple of key points there. There was some other stuff too, but it's not really as it was. Which was kind of nice to hear and be shown, but it wasn't really of huge interest outside. So we spent most of the day with the Outback.
We did.
basically, it was a case of, right, what will we have? Oh, there's a nice big shiny one there. We'll take that one.
And we'll go on the road first, please, because everyone else wants to go off-road.
Yes, we've got all day. We're just down the road, literally just down the road from my house. So we're not in a huge rush. So the first thing we did was we took a 2-litre diesel out back with the Alineatronic gearbox. So Subaru don't seem to do really an automatic, certainly not in the UK at the moment. They do a CVT gearbox, which, as I say, is called Alineatronic. Makes a lot of sense in a Subaru, really, because it saves you, because you've got that sort of infinite band of, no pun intended.
Well, yeah, explain to people who don't know what Alineatronic is, then.
Oh, nice one. Thank you. So Alineatronic is continuously variable transmission. For those of you who aren't aware what continuously variable transmission is, it's in traditional automatic gearboxes, in automated manual gearboxes, and in manual gearboxes, you have a set number of ratios. So there are going to be four gears, five gears, six gears in there. And they are defined ratios. And there's a lot of clunking about that goes on, either driven manually by you shifting a lever and pushing a pedal, or by hydraulic pressure that changes you between those. Continuously variable transmission is slightly different. It runs from, the very early versions were a pair of cones, basically, with a rubber band around them. Now, this is not the Subaru one, okay? I'll explain in a minute. And basically, by moving the band back and forth across these cones, you could vary the ratio that was going out. What this means is that the engine can run at the sort of best possible set of revs for torque and stuff, and the gearbox changes. So your gears are constantly lengthening. The speed that one shaft going to the other shaft as it comes out of the engine is constantly changing. So it's your drivetrain that accelerates, not your engine, if you get what I mean. That was appalling as a definition. The early ones, stuff like DAFs, I had not practiced this at all, so this is off the top of my head. Rubber band. In the Subaru, it's a metal chain, a metal link chain that does it, and of course it's two actual bobbin shapes rather than cones that does it. And so that's really good because it saves you having to have high and low ratio in something like a Subaru, where you want on road and you want off road. The gearbox is super smooth, by the way. The only time that it sounds like a mooing cow, which is one of the key criticisms of continuously variable transmissions, is if you wide open throttle from a standstill, pulling out of a junction,
and it's cold.
It gets better when it's warm. It just kind of. The engine revs up and it just kind of takes a second or two to wind itself into position. And then you're out the junction and you've not been hit by the trucks and stuff.
Yeah, because I'd say that is the one thing that took some adjustment was that there was a fraction of a second delay.
Yeah.
When you put your foot down.
If you nailed it.
But you quickly understood that and adapted to it. That wasn't that's not a criticism. It's just something
after a week of ownership, you'd be used to it.
You wouldn't even notice it was doing it. I don't think. I mean, we were so comfortable with it just on the back end of an hour's drive or half an hour each. So
yeah. And I mean, there was a great advantage on this particular launch. You'd had it when you were driving the Ioniq not so long ago. Is that I knew the roads. Mm. Okay, so they're all the roads around me, and it took me on one of my normal cycling routes and stuff, and basically some of the roads that if I'm going out for a RAS in the MX-5 or the Yaris, then those are the roads I choose. So, I mean,
you got to throw it around more than you would have if you didn't know those roads.
I did, yes.
And I'm not saying recklessly or anything, but I'm just saying you approached corners faster.
Andrew,
and I didn't scream.
He didn't scream, and he wasn't doing the ghost pedal thing that I noticed. So I can't have been doing too badly.
There were claw marks in the dashboard.
Yes. I'm sorry, so, Jade. Andrew sunk his fingers into the soft.
So at no point was I fearful. However, you did approach stuff quicker than because you knew the road, and I quickly understood you knew the road. So I was fine with it. But having said that, what was the grip like?
Well, the thing is that you'd never describe this as being a dramatic or exciting car to drive. What it was is hugely, hugely competent. And it just, there was, for what we were doing, I mean, we weren't doing silly speeds. We were on damp roads, twisty corners.
We were all well within the speed limits and things like that.
Yeah, we were. But it was just incredibly composed. So it just, you turned the wheel and it generally just went where you expected it. There wasn't, it wasn't a case of, oh God, it's not going to get around the corner or
and
anything
it did
like
it comfortably.
That. It was invisible. And that's what's, I mean, that's, my family, when I, part of it, Andrew, was that I was very comfortable with it because when I learned to drive, when I passed my test, my parents had a Subaru Legacy. So when I started out, I was driving Subaru Legacy.
Yeah, but that was, you know, many years ago when the world was black and white.
Yeah, but it just felt the same. And I mean that in the, you know, apart from the fact that the cabin was significantly nicer and the car's a bit bigger, then it just felt the same. It was very, very secure. It's kind of how you'd expect a Subaru to feel. That sounds terrible cop-out.
Yes, but the way you're describing it,
right.
I don't think does it justice because that could come across as just being, oh, it's a tool that did the job. And I think we both really enjoyed the car. I certainly did.
Oh, I did. Yes, sorry. I did. So and this, I enjoyed positioning it.
We're not talking it down when we said, you know, it does the job really, you know, competently and well, and there's no fuss. That's not to do it down at all, because this was actually very enjoyable. We were sitting in there going, I really like this. And you turn to me and go, but I really like this. And we look at cars at almost opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, I was obviously looking at it and thinking, the cracked windscreen hoard in here. That's a good shout. Oh, this is, you know, apart from the space, you know, there's obviously an estate. So, I can take all the filth. And then, you know, but there's plenty of room in the back. And actually, it's driving along very comfortably. We're not, you know, if we go over undulations, it's not in a harsh manner.
So one of the things that really impressed me was there was very little body roll. So we're in the Outback, so it was that little bit, you know, it's a state car, it's raised up a bit. Very nice high-profile tyres. Some of the roads, I mean, I don't know, Andrew, if you actually appreciated just how some of those roads in Rutland and that north corner in Northamptonshire. It's the roads suck, basically. And this was making progress very smoothly, very quickly, very little roll, and with very little fuss. I mean, there was one
when the
roads flattened
out.
Like
I said, I mean, I've mentioned it a couple of times here because I can't, I'm struggling to get over this, but it wasn't in a spine shattering way.
No, it was floaty. It wasn't floaty. Floaty sounds bad. You just didn't notice it. It got rid of the minor undulations and imperfections in the road very, very well. There you go. That's all I can think of to say that doesn't sound like some kind of motoring journalist backhanded. Well, it was this, but actually it was that type of thing going on here. But it sounds a bit gushy, but to be honest, for where we were, the flat corner of the country...
I think we were really surprised because I think we were expecting a bit more of a workhorse-type vehicle.
I was expecting the Outback to feel more agricultural than it did.
Mm.
As it was, we got to the end of that, and I was thinking, the Levorg's a little bit smaller. I quite like the Levorg. And sort of planning sort of alternative things to spec up on the internet later on. has happened with me. So on the road, I could also see myself covering large distances very comfortably in it.
Absolutely.
mean, I was in the driver's seat for half an hour and there was a bit hopping in and out, but the seat seemed comfortable enough. Vehicles, the whole car seemed pretty...
Well, I was actually impressed with the touchscreen. Because
after the grief you've been given about touchscreen.
Well, exactly. But the touchscreen had sort of buttons.
Yeah, it was a weird hybrid. It was sort of touch buttons, but there was an indent, so partly you could see where you were aiming your finger for at the corner of your eye.
But you could feel it.
You knew when you'd met it.
Mm.
And it was a pretty slick system, actually. Mm. It wasn't too bad at all.
The screen was very clear. Nice.
Mm-hmm. Clear. You poked about more with the other options than I did, to be honest.
Well, I got to see the way it was communicating what the wheels were doing on the the engine was doing, and what was the live miles per gallon, which was actually quite impressive.
Yeah, for a big,
considering
for
we just hopped car. In it, and you know we. I don't want to say because we weren't driving it hard and we weren't being silly, but. We equally weren't trying to mega mile it either.
No, we were absolutely not trying to hyper mile it.
And, you know, that sort of information was interesting to see. And, yeah, it told you lots of information. Had, you know, the sat-nav had the... I will always appreciate a sat-nav that has what is the speed limit you should be doing.
Yeah,
indicator. I know most do that these days, but I will always appreciate seeing that because there's so many times you're going in and out of towns. Even if you know the areas, you know, next week the speed limit could change. And I think it's just a great little feature.
But yeah, especially if you're like me and you go lots of strange places, you're going.
Yeah, I'm digressing. I'm focusing on a tiny little detail there. This. So when we got back, though, what did we do?
We went for our lunch, Andrew. That's what we did.
No, we didn't.
We didn't, actually. I've just juggled the order around here. So some of you may have seen on Instagram during the week, actually quite a few of you did, which is quite nice to see, that I posted a little video of Andrew testing out the EyeSight active safety system, which Subaru is... rightfully, I think, very proud of, which is a camera-based safety system. I wasn't going into the technicalities. I was waiting until you asked me about them. A camera-based active safety system, which basically looks out for what looks like a car in front of you, or what looks like an obstacle in front of you, and can warn you that you might hit it, tell you that you're going to hit it, and then just slam on the brakes so that hopefully you don't hit it.
Yep.
Just there. And there was a video of us testing that. Well, yeah, it was so impressive the first time because I went first and I wussed out and I actually already had my foot on the brake before we'd stopped because it just freaked me out. Andrew managed to, having seen that it did actually stop us and having seen evidence of that, Andrew managed to keep his foot in and we'll probably add the video into a little blog post on the site there, just showing what it did, because you were going faster than me to start off with, and then you didn't really lift off as the car jammed us to a stop and cut the throttle.
Yeah, I mean, I had to double check that she really did want me to drive.
You did. I left that bit in the video. The
car. Are you sure? Right. Okay.
You sure? Fine. Just drive. Yeah. Just drive as if you've not noticed it.
Fine.
So there was that, and then also the fact that it won't let you. It's a cunning thing in that unless you really kind of hold the throttle, then it won't sort of let you drive into barriers and stuff, even if you start there. So the idea is that if you inadvertently put the transmission into drive instead of reverse, or reverse instead of drive, then basically it will go not beep beep beep.
Yeah. So if you're in a queue of traffic, or if you're in a car park, it senses there's something in front of you and just says nope.
All the classic thinking the person in front of you it has started to move to pull out a junction.
Mm, yeah,
was the other one. That was where I could really see that because that's such a common accident. So it's trying to sort some of that care stuff. So, that was really impressive. And as I say, we'll do a little write-up of this for later in the week. And I'll incorporate the video into that, I think. Mm.
Okay. Then we had lunch.
Then we had lunch. And after lunch, we went off-road. Do you want to talk about this? Because I've done off-roading in the past, and you hadn't done it.
I have never off-roaded. And we were in an Outback again. We deliberately picked an Outback because we'd been on the road. We wanted to compare it to something we'd been in before, so we didn't want to pick the Forester or the XV because we'd not been in those yet. And we think that would have been unfair because the XV and the Forester were obviously had more ground clearance and that sort of thing. So we picked something we knew. And
what's nice is that the Subaru kept the spec for the ones that we were using off-roading was exactly the same as the ones for on-road.
Yes.
It's just that they, for that particular day, had been assigned for off-road duty, whereas maybe they'd done on-road the day before. So it's same tyres, everything.
Yeah, they had road tyres. They did not have specific off-road tyres. They did not have winter tyres, anything special. They were just normal tyres. So, like we said at the outset of this, it was very wet. It was the grass on the fields we went through was slick, so you went at things. We had an instructor who was great at talking us through it, and he was very patient. Thank God, he needed to be with me.
It's like all of these guys. If you think driving instructors are chilled individuals, then off-road driving instructors are like the next level above that. I wonder what they're popping to keep themselves quite so chilled. To be honest.
Then, so we started off, you were driving the car initially, and we started on the road, and immediately we go to a downhill bit, so we got to test the hill descent control, which you press the button, and what I did when I was driving it is I went slightly down the hill with my foot on the brake, and that seemed to set a speed for it.
That's what I did as well, by the way.
Okay. And then it set a speed which was, for me, very a slow.
A bit too quick. Sorry, yes.
And then it would hold the car at that, and it would be, you could feel it braking, and you could feel the occasional slide as the brakes came on and stuff like that, and then it would take you down that speed. And then as you got down to the bottom of a dip and you were about to go up somewhere else, you'd then put your foot down to gently take you away. Mm-hmm. And I was massively impressed with that technology. Like I say, I've never done anything like this before, and I'm in effectively a road car on road tires, and we were going up and down some really impressive undulations, a lot of mud, very sticky places through quite a bit of water. I mean, we've got in your blog post, Alan, I presume we'll put pictures and I think we've got a couple of other videos of one or the other of us trying to get it in and out of different places as well. So we'll show you exactly the terrain we were putting.
Trouble is that the photographs don't actually, that you lose a bit of the steepness. I mean, there's a couple where you can see where we're going out through the sunroof.
Yes, out through to the try and give an impression.
Yeah.
It's when you see it through the sunroof where we're supposed to end up, then you know that's quite steep. And I mean, there was one particular point that I got stuck, but I think that was more me not being used to going off road. It wasn't the vehicle, because we found a route that would get us out. And then when you did it, you got straight out, straight away.
Yeah, that's the skills, man.
Something like that.
Yeah, no, it was great. Off-road, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I've done a fair bit of off-roading over the years. But, yeah, really impressive. Just what it's essentially a car jacked up an inch or two can actually do. And just what the four-wheel drive system can pull us through. It was every condition. We're being very careful here because we're trying not to sound too cliched and too gushing. And we're failing miserably.
It's difficult, but, because we were, well, I know you were, but I was so impressed. I was impressed. I was blown away because I was expecting it to be, A, as you said earlier, more agricultural. Mm-hmm. And B, I was not expecting it to be able to do the off-road stuff that it could. And that EyeSight tech was just almost icing on cake.
Yeah.
The ability of that was amazing.
I had high expectations of the Super Off-Road at the beginning of the day, and I was still impressed. Just by what they said, just go through it and do the same. It's the same off-road courses that the other companies launch pickup trucks on.
Yes, he was explaining.
Okay, that's that. So many of the pickup trucks on the road in the UK have been launched. They've used that as the launch course for them to show off to journalists and stuff. Mm. Subaru were doing the same with an estate car. Right, that's all you need to know.
Yeah, quite. But that wasn't the only thing we drove, though, was it?
That wasn't the only thing we drove. Towards the end of the day, once we had been back and had a cup of coffee.
And it's gone. Wow, and it's a gone. Lot.
I had a mince pie, actually. It's very nice. Broke one of my rules about having mince pies outside of December. But we went out and we took a Forester. We completely ignored the road routes from Subaru. And we took the Forester to a forest.
We did. And we have pictures to prove it.
We do. Many of which have appeared on Instagram and Twitter already. Or at least a couple of them. But it was... the Forester was manual, so it wasn't linear-tronic, which was a bit of a shock to my system anyway. The Forester was certainly a bit more agricultural than the Outback. It didn't have the same...
The engine note did come through.
The engine note came through very much... Well, you could actually hear engine note, which you couldn't unless you were... It was sort of moving a little bit on wide open throttle on the Outback. But in the Forester, it was... and the interior was very much more the harder plastics that I associate with Subaru interiors. And you can dismiss it for that, and you can go, well, it's not exactly a Golf. About this kind of thing, but the thing about the Forester is that you know that those plastics will look just the same in 5 years of hard use. But the touch points themselves, the bits where you aren't reach out and go, I wonder what the dashboard feels like. So the steering wheel, the gear knob, the little bit where you can rest, if you're a lazy tow rag like me, you can rest your elbow on the door or on the door handle.
Well, that actually had a cushion,
were fabric. It was all cushioned and fabricy. It was very nice.
That was nice. That was nice to see because there's so many cars don't bother doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was nice about it was a cooking spec one, so to speak. So it was cloth seats and it wasn't exactly a hair shirt to sit in, but it wasn't super press spec or anything.
No, it was realistic,
one, which was quite nice. Big sunroof. I can't remember what spec it was. Hang on a minute. I do actually have a crib sheet here. It was an XC manual, so it was the standard spec. It didn't have sat nav or any of these things, and it was manual, but it was quite nice. It worked a treat. I was impressed by the Forester,
by the handling.
But it was the handling was great. So whilst it looks, the Forester's much taller than it used to be. It used to basically be what's now an Outback. It was essentially an estate car that was jacked up a bit, really. Forester, it's grown a bit in height to become more of a Suzuki Vitara, but I would question which would be the better off-road nowadays, the Vitara or the Forester. In the past, I would always have said the Vitara, but I think it's got softer whilst the Forester has maintained or gained.
Yeah, I think
its place.
If I needed off-road ability plus the height and space that the Forester offered, I would go for that over the Vitara or one of those ilks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the funny thing about both the Outback and the Forester, there's only 3 brake horsepower between them. It's the same engine, it's the same bore, it's the same stroke, the same diesel engine in there. It's the same 2-litre diesel engine, I should point out. But in the Forester, it's 147 brake. It's 150 brake. Sort of metric brake. In the Outback, it's the same engine. It's purely the way it's been packaged, and the the vehicle between the engine and you that's different.
Yeah. I was very impressed
in both cases,
actually. Because that's one I approached with a bit of trepidation, because I've always loved the look of the earlier versions as the slightly jacked up estate.
Mm-hmm.
But having been in it and driven it and experienced it, I was quite impressed. I was quite surprised.
I mean, if I lived around my parents, you'd be more likely to pick the Forester over some of the other cars I'd choose buying. You know, living on the housing estate in the middle. You know. But yeah, really, I was impressed by the Forester. I was quite pleased with it. Lovely thing to drive. Really impressed. I was really impressed by that. So it was a good day out. It was.
I mean, it's the only problem with these days is they're never long enough, because we didn't. You know, there was just no physical way we could have tried the other's cars.
I would love to try the XV. I've driven the XV off road before in May, and I do like it. But that's because it's a slightly weird car that nobody else would ever choose, and therefore it appeals to me. it's true.
But I think that's a bit of a mistake, isn't it? Because it looks good.
Yeah, it looks good. It's just because it's not anything that anybody ever recognises or buys doesn't mean it's a bad thing.
And it would have been great to try to have the chance to try the LeVorg as well.
Yeah,
but thank you to Subaru for the invite. Actually,
yes, thanks, folks.
No, thank you very much for inviting us down. Because it was really interesting. It certainly changed my perceptions.
All it did was reinforce mine, to be perfectly honest.
Well, I've not experienced, you see. I wanted. You know, I've not had the chance to experience. So I found it very helpful and useful from that point of view, that now I can speak with a little bit of knowledge, as opposed to just an opinion.
And if there is a blue car with gold wheels driving day, then Andrew's probably not interested, but I'll be along.
Oh.
No, thank you, folks. It was good. Me, yeah, totally. Shall we round up? Because we have waffled quite a lot there.
Yes.
Gushed quite a bit too, which is it's not like us.
So that goes to show how impressed we were, people.
Yes, yeah, totally. Finally, just a quick one. Ford have done a rather tongue-in-cheek a little bit of publicity for the Focus RS by showing by recreating an advert from November 1986. So 30 years ago.
40? Come on, steady on.
The maths isn't strong. I was like, that can't be right. I'm younger than that. So from 30 years ago, it showed, a sort of tongue-in-cheek picture of a police-liveried RS200 with a policeman who is acting out, giving a ticket to a driver of a Sierra RS Cosworth. This year they did something slightly different to mark 30 years of that, and on exactly 30 days later they published a picture of an RS200 which very much gave the look of having been stopped by a policeman in a Ford Focus RS in exactly the same lay-by at the side of exactly the same road with the same sign in the background. They recreated it but switched it around, basically showing that nowadays the Focus RS is quicker than the RS200. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a good one. It's a nice one. There's a nice sort of synopsis summary of it all on Motoring Research. So thank you, Richard, and the chaps at Motoring Research for that. There will be a link, as ever, in the show notes.
Yep.
And that pretty much sums it up for this week, doesn't it?
It does, that's it. I think.
Yeah. I do think that that's us been through this week's news. It's been kind of quiet news wise. I think it's just a week after Los Angeles show, and there'll be a little bit of a lull.
Well, there seems to be a few launches going on all at once.
Yes, lots of stuff today. New Ford Fiesta has been unveiled in detail whilst we've been recording. Although pictures were leaking out earlier on in the day, people were playing with this new Suzuki Ignis today, mm-hmm. which looks lovely.
We're not jealous at all.
No. I've run out of holidays anyway. So new Suzuki Ignis, which is lovely. Yes, I'd like to pick one up and take it home with me, to be perfectly honest.
It'd fit in your backpack, wouldn't it?
It would do. And they've got great names too. What was it you were saying the four-wheel drive was called? Is it twin drive or something? No.
No, it's... I can't remember now.
God, it was really witty earlier on when we were talking about it.
Oh, it was hilarious. Trust us.
Yeah, just awesome.
We should wrap up now, Alan.
I do think we should wrap up. So, everyone, don't forget that between now and next week, you can give us any feedback and share your thoughts with the show at Motoring Podcast on Twitter and Instagram, on Facebook, and on the contact page of motoringpodcast.com, the hub of all our activities. Please don't forget to leave a review and rating on iTunes or whichever podcast app you choose to use. It really does matter. Andrew, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Best way would be via Twitter, where if you search for Crap Windscreen, you will find me. And if people want to get in touch with you, Alan, what is the best way?
Twitter again, where I'm at AJPBradley. We'll both be back next week. There'll be a special edition later in the week.
There is a special edition later in the week.
And, of course, Rearview on Friday morning. But until then, I've been Alan Bradley.
I've been Andrew Clues.
And safe motoring.